Greetings, lovely people. I am Farida, your aspartame-driven host on this podcast submarine called The Slow Dive. Thank you for supporting our newbie podcast and our purpose, Listen, Reflect, and Connect. I'm excited to dive in with our guest today, producer and production executive Pamela Monroe. Pamela Monroe, originally from Idaho and an Air Force veteran, is a distinguished Pepperdine University graduate in business management. Her career spans roles in managerial finance across aerospace, construction, and healthcare before venturing into the entertainment industry. Monroe has developed financial systems for studios like DreamWorks, Disney, and Fox. She transitioned to film production, contributing to Planet of the Apes and Bedazzled. She worked as an assistant director and producer on films and TV series, including Coach Carter, Obsessed, Drive, Alias, and Grey's Anatomy. Her production credits include The Persian Connection, Jackals, and projects for Blumhouse and Amazon. As a former Amazon Original Movies executive, she oversaw films such as The Burial and Something from Tiffany's, along with key documentaries. Monroe is dedicated to producing stories that inspire reflection and positive change. Thank you, Pamela, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, well, we're excited. Well, our first segment, we just start off with like an icebreaker. So I'm going to ask you a question. Where was the most incredible place you visited recently?
This weekend was pretty interesting because I went to Santa Barbara with a dear friend of mine who is also a neighbor. Her name is Monica White, and she plays old-time music. She taught a workshop on how to play the spoons. And then Sunday, I went and watched her and her twin sister tell about their surviving in Shanghai, where they were born during the Holocaust.
Wow.
So they are, you know, Holocaust survivors from the, they escaped Germany, but then they got stuck in Shanghai.
Wow.
And that was rather interesting. And the Museum of Tolerance here in Los Angeles is just so filled with information. I would suggest anyone go there, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And so the performance was spoons. That's so fascinating. That's so cool. So they actually use spoons like the utensil.
Yeah. The utensil, cool. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I have to look into that. That's actually very cool. That's very unique. Yeah. I would never have thought that. Okay.
Yeah. And she also plays the banjo and the guitar, you know, but yeah.
Are you working on a documentary on her? Because that would be very interesting.
You know what? We have started the discussions about that, honestly.
Yeah, I would love that. She sounds like a very fascinating person as well. Well, that's fun. I know you a little bit from one of our projects, but I'm so excited that you're a producer, a production executive. You have a very fascinating story into production. So we'll just start our first segment. How did you get into your work? I know it was by chance, right? I think the word you used was destiny.
Destiny. Yeah. I don't think chance had, I think destiny is different than chance. That's chance, but someone, you know, is maybe pulling the strings from above. I don't know. But that's my version of destiny. I was born in the Midwest, but raised in Idaho in the Northwest, and poor family, youngest of six girls. And, dreaming of doing anything other than having a job and living paycheck to paycheck seemed ludicrous, to say the least. So, but I loved movies and since I was 6 years old, and TV shows, and I did theater since I was like 13. So that was the focus of my life, honestly, growing up through my teens. I joined the Air Force to get out of Idaho and have more of a life than I saw there. And even in the Air Force, when I was in basic training, I auditioned I was there during Christmas, which is the highest like suicide attempt rate lucid trainees of the year. So to make it a little, give them a little something with levity, even though you were a basic trainee, you could audition for the base Christmas show, of which I did.
Oh, cool.
And I did a few dance numbers, a singing number. I spoofed the training instructors. I did a comedy skit spoofing a TI. That was made me very popular after the show with the TIs. They would call me out a lot. And I also became the stage manager because I knew theater. I knew the stage. So that's how I did my basic training. When I got out of the Air Force, I came back to California, to the Los Angeles area, and very good at computers and became a designer of computer software. And there was a particular software that the company I worked with invented called a multi-dimensional database. And when someone gives a new technology, you know, the biggest want it, right? So at that time, I think Oracle was definitely the biggest database company in the world. Mm-hmm. And so they bought it. They bought the company. And that's their OLAP program. And so there was about six of us that knew how to design in it. And there was this startup company created by, you know, Steven Spielberg. And they wanted someone who could design in this technology. So my friend, also a designer in this technology, let me know about it. And I called and I had an interview and I was hired 2 days later.
Wow. So, just because I'm a little bit familiar, but I was going to say, so you started off in the theater as a basic trainee in the Air Force. And then you also did other work in the military. And then you found yourself at DreamWorks.
Yeah.
And that was what, like in a period of like a couple of years, 4 years?
Well, I was in the Air Force for 4 years. And then I came out a couple years after that, of which I was, you know, working in hospital systems, designing software, and then came DreamWorks. So probably 6 or 7 years.
How many women were working at DreamWorks, Elise, when you first started there?
Actually, it was a pretty good amount of women.
Okay.
DreamWorks, I think, was a little bit different because Spielberg, Katzenberg, and Geffen wanted the original DreamWorks studio to be not like the others. Mm-hmm. So they would hire some people from other studios, but they would also hire people who weren't in studios and, you know, who had expertise in their field and their skills. So that's what gave me the in. And that's why I think I couldn't see in that world, a men competing over women. Like I had a female boss and who was the CIO. I had a male boss who was the CIO when I was there. So I think it was pretty even, especially for that time period.
That's great. I love that. I learned this about you because there's so many different avenues and non-linear paths to come into production or as a producer or producer executive, production executive like yourself. So I like how, you went from aerospace to construction to to high-level hospital database management to then DreamWorks. So so you have like a really good arsenal of like skill sets that I think, would you say would like really, they lent to your work there at DreamWorks? Or as a studio executive?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I feel like I'm one of those people that, you know, I don't like to be put in a box. And I feel like people judge people too much and they say, oh, this person has done this. Even when, you know, when I wasn't in production and jumped into, you know, production as a production accountant from being in the corporate side of the business, it was like, oh, you know, I used to design financial software. And then coming into production, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, can she become, can she be an assistant, a first assistant accountant? You know, because she's hasn't done, you know, production accounting. That's like basic bookkeeping.
So it's, yeah,
you know, so yeah, they automatically, I think people gravitate towards the safe and someone who's done exactly that before, but they don't always give someone the opportunity, even though they are more than capable.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So, I mean, people have the skill set and the potential, but they don't have the opportunity to like either develop their talent or to, you know, pivot or transferable skill sets that, you know, they will flourish in this other setting. I agree with that very much because I think, I don't know, Pamela, tell me if you agree. Producers are kind of elusive because they're either, they're strategic thinkers. So you have to have like a lot of different skill sets to be accomplished and successful producer, putting out fires and having backup plans. Is there any projects that you found yourself, you were like, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this, but you surprised yourself and you're like, this is a great project. And you're like, I can't believe is there like a career highlight of yours while working in the producing world that you'd like to share?
Sometimes I feel like I can't believe I did a lot of things. I feel like, you know, the fact that I'm here and I'm a, you know, the little girl in me from Idaho, can't believe that, you know, I'm sitting in a, you know, at the DGA on a table full of like some of the most popular directors in the world, right? That, you know, I was on the council, that people cared what I thought, you know. I think that mattered a lot to me, honestly. I feel like when I first see, like, you know, there was a TV show, short-lived, you know, one season, 20 episodes, I think 21 maybe, called Flash Forward. And I was the assistant EPM, so to speak, with a lot of the second units, or the, you know, studio would want to rewrite something. And it was just like that on the fly, let's get this. And it wouldn't be the main unit, right? And I would be told on Tuesday, hey, we're going to shoot something on Thursday. Don't know yet what. We'll get you the scene. We think it's going to be these actors, you know, or we would do like all the second unit, like, oh, we're going to blow up a Humvee. Okay. You know, so I was.
No big deal.
Yeah. We're going to sink a bus in a tank and have 20 stunt people. Like half of them will act like they're drowning and the other half will be able to like get out and float. You know, that kind of thing. Those are amazing times for me, right? I worked on Planet of the Apes in 2000, right, for Tim Burton, before we had CG, you know, to the level it is now. And yeah. So it was like makeup, right? It was like seeing people like 4 hours into makeup and actually, you know, seeing a orangutan, you know, walking around, or a chimpanzee, or, you know, that kind of thing. Just, and riding horses and, you know, stuff like that.
Planet of the Apes, love that film. And I love the original TV series that it was, I guess it was a book and then it was a TV series and then they made a film, right? Or was it always a movie?
It was a movie first.
Oh, okay.
With Charlton Heston. And yes. Ironically, Charlton Heston was an old ape in the Tim Burton version in 2000.
Oh, was he? Oh,
yeah, he was like, okay. If I remember correctly, we had him in bed. He was on his deathbed or something.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So. That's, well, Tim Burton is wildly creative. So that's such a cool experience that you got to, I mean, I love learning. And that's a tent pole. It's a big production, Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, back
and
then.
How especially. Many people were on set that you were like working with? Like,
I mean, there were hundreds of background. We had done it at different, like, we had a stage at Sony, mm-hmm. Their biggest stage at the time. We had the dome down in Long Beach, you know, or that might have been a different movie, sorry. We also had a lot of it in, God, what's it called? The out in the desert, the Trona Pinnacles. So we had a lot out there in the Trona Pinnacles, and at the time our base camp was a mile long. We had the longest base camp in history at that time. I'm sure it's probably Marvel's done longer than that since then, but you know, it was a lot.
You mentioned you being in the DGA program, the DGA Women's Steering Committee. Could you tell us a little bit more about your role in that for any of our listeners who are unfamiliar with the steering committee at DGA?
Yeah. And here's what I would love to say to any young filmmaker, that anyone that wants to be in this business. I wanted nothing more than to be in this business since I was a child. But I didn't know how. And I didn't know what was there. I didn't have people who grew up in this business. I didn't grow up seeing the different things you could do in this business, right? So I had to kind of get my way in where I could and then learn on the way. My advice to anyone else, I don't think you have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to go to film school. If you have it and you can, great, do it. But there's a lot of ways now you can research and find out what different positions you can do in this business and what gravitates towards you if you're an art person and want to be in art department or whatever. So that I used my accounting, right? I used that to get out of designing software and stuff for, you know, DreamWorks and Disney. And then I, you know, went into production accounting while I learned as a production accountant what I could do. I also was a transportation office coordinator. And that's when I learned about the DGA training program. So I applied, and my year, less than 1% that actually took the test. So it was over 3,000 of us that took, they had testing back then and everything, got in actually into the final stage. It was there that I learned about the DGA. And I'm the type of person that if you're going to be part of something, i.e. a guild, that's going to protect you. Maybe it's my Air Force training, but you want to be a part of that, right? You want to be a part of the decision-making there. You want to learn why they make the decisions they make, because your life is affected, right? My salary is affected. My pension's affected. My working hours are affected. So why would you not want to be a part of figuring out how they make the decisions they make? So I started going to meetings. And then, someone told me that there's at that time it was a fledgling women's steering committee. I could go to that and learn more. I went to that, and it was a lot, maybe different back then. It was not formed as well. We didn't have the Me Too movement. It was very difficult to promote women, you know, up. Not just directors, but that seemed to be the focus on the Women's Steering Committee. But there was a few of us that were assistant directors. They were going to stop doing this event that they did once a year because the directors, you know, the chairs at the time were all directors. And they didn't really want to, it takes a lot, honestly, to produce this. It's a below-the-line mixer so that women ADs, female ADs and, you know, different diverse ADs that don't have the connections can meet like 5 minutes. It's like 7 minute speed dating, you know, where we give a book of resumes and you kind of meet all that. Anyway, they weren't going to do it. And that's the one event that the not directors, the assistant directors want. We wanted to meet this, and I had worked on one the year before, and I knew how important it was. You know, I played a hostess for it, so you know, I did get to meet a lot of the VIPs, got work from that, got my friends that came in, did the, you know, they got work from it. I thought it was a good thing. I kind of raised my hand and we spoke, and I, you know, a friend of mine and I were saying this is needed. We need this, guys. This is the one event that you do for assistant directors and not directors. we need to keep this. And basically I was told that if I wanted to keep it, I had to produce it. Mm-hmm. So for the next 6 years, I produced it.
Amazing.
And, yeah.
Now that impact of that committee, it placed a lot of women into, like you said, projects and collaborations and connections that, you know, you need those connector organizations such as DGA.
Yeah. Well, the year after I did that one, I became a co-chair the next year. So,
are you still serving in the DGA? No.
I'm still in the DGA.
DGA,
I'm
yes.
just not, I'm serving on a committee or two, but not the Women's Steering Committee. You know, mm-hmm. It's evolved a lot since then. Mm-hmm. It's become a lot more prestigious. Directors want to be a part of it. And that is, you know, it's amazing. It's hopefully doing some more work. I think everything's evolving and it's doing well. And now the whole diversity task force has grown. There's, you know, a whole bunch of different, you know, committees. And now they do a diversity task force, kind of a same kind of below the line mixer.
No, this is great. I think a lot of our audience will really appreciate your insight on the DGA and also the different task force and committees there, because I think, I mean, Pamela, I'd love to know what you think about this. Where we are right now, currently in the entertainment landscape, I mean, we need more, I feel like we need more gate openers, door opening, connecting organizations more than ever, because we don't know what's happening. It's rapidly shifting. And what do you think someone right now with your incredible experience and insight, what would you tell someone who's like an emerging producer right now, who wants to, you know, grow up in the ranks in the production world? What would be some pointers you would give to them? Maybe perhaps even a woman, or just in general, like an emerging mm-hmm. producer. Like, how do they stay positive and stay above this? And what could they do in this weird time that we're in the industry?
My first thing would be, you know what, there's a whole bunch of different ways to produce. Know what you want and be careful what you ask for. Because, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people see, you know, big time, big name producers and they go, oh, I want to be that. And they don't understand sometimes. Some producers are there because they, you know, have the finance or they have the connections and they can get the ball rolling and get people to meet the right people, right? Mm-hmm. Then there's the other producers who came up through the ranks, like myself, who really get the chance to do it because they know what they're doing on how to produce. So I'm, you know, most of my experience was a line producer, you know, going up from a UPM or unit production manager through the DGA. I went from assistant director, UPM, line producer, you know, now I produce. It's be prepared for long, long hours that, you know, be prepared for being able to, problem solve. Honestly, if you're a good problem solver quickly, you know, that's a main thing, right? Mm-hmm. If you have connections or have a way of gathering people together, you know, they're young. As their people move up, so should they, right? But know like the ways in, I mean, that the skills they have, then know what those skills can do and how they can relate it, but also learn a lot because it's not glamorous. It's really not, you know, it's a lot of work and you have to be prepared for that work in order to get up there.
I think for people who are not in the entertainment or production or film industry, they don't realize how much goes into just the final piece. and yes, it is a lot of work. So well, then what makes it rewarding, Pamela, for you? Like when you put in those 20-hour days on set or like turnarounds, which are like overnighters and you're doing all these things, you're putting out fires, you're coming up with the contingency, all that, you're strategically thinking, What makes it rewarding for you that keeps you going, even though it is actually incredibly hard work? But what's rewarding for you? Just so I would like to know, like, what keeps you going in that regard?
I think the first thing is when you are working on a project, now you can't always get to choose what you love, right? The big guns in our industry get to choose what they want to do, what they want to work on. But most of us, I'd say 95% of us, don't get that choice, right? A lot of times it's you get, you know, called or recommended for a specific kind of show. And you do it to your best of your ability. So I think that the thing I get out of every production, every single production that I've been in is I always used to say that it's weird, but for every production, no matter if it's 4 months or 10 months or longer or shorter, there's always someone you meet that's fascinating. There's always someone you meet. There's like two or three friends that become your friends for years. You may not see all of them all of the time, but you always have that wonderful feeling, that wonderful bond, you know, with them. That is one that comes no matter what the show. There's always someone that, you know, you meet the kind of people that you want to have in your life. The other thing is on the shows, you think, God, this is really great writing. It's smart. You know, even when I'm day playing on something, meaning it's not my show, but they need extra help, right? It's so fascinating to see when you see I worked on that and seeing the final show and going, you know, wow, that was amazing, you know. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what makes me happy. And to give a project that says something to the world, right?
Yeah. Was there anything you've worked on? I mean, I know you have a wonderful list of projects you've worked on, but like as a, specifically as your role as a in the movies recently that you're just like really connected with you in, is there something, a project you can talk about or that you're like, they're all great, I'm sure. No,
they're really not. I don't think anyone can say that they're all great, honestly.
Yes, that's true. That's true, actually. That's true.
But, you know, I mean, I worked, it's weird. Like, I don't know if we want to talk about like different shorts or.
Yeah,
you know,
no, I was definitely going to get into Almost Home, but I was, I wanted to know, like, as a production executive, when you were working at, with Amazon and all that, what kind of films in that role did you find connected with you that you enjoyed or you thought that was needed? If you could speak to that.
Sure. I was lucky enough to work, you know, with a lot of new directors. I helped some of them, like, you know, get their paperwork ready and everything so that they could actually even join the DGA.
Oh, wow.
In their first, like, big directing thing. Some of them were lighthearted and wonderful. I worked on a movie called The Burial a couple of years ago now, Jamie Foxx. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's one I really liked that said, "Don't make me go. Don't make me go." Is not what anyone expects it to be. And it's wonderful. And it's so, you know, poignant. It's got great relationship with, you know, father, daughter.
I am going to put that on my list because I have heard of it, but I have not seen it. And Don't Make Me Go. Is that a drama? Is it indie?
It is, well, it's an Amazon original.
Oh, yes.
Honestly, the director on Don't Make Me Go was a first time female director. She was an actress, you know, growing up, and you know, I mentioned that I worked on that show Flash Forward.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting because on Don't Make Me Go, the father figure was John Cho, okay, the lead actor in it. And I was, you know, talking to the new director and everything and saying, oh, it's really great. You know, I've worked with John before. He's a fascinating, wonderful guy. And she's like, oh, I worked with him too. And I was like, oh, really? When did you work with him? And she said, I worked with him on Flash Forward. And I was like, okay. I worked on Flash Forward.
Yeah, the synchronicity.
And
you guys are.
She's like, we had worked together before. Her name is Hannah Marks. She was like, she played the little sister of one of our other actors on it. She had never been in a scene with John. So that's the thing about Flash Forward is there was, you know, several different stories happening at the same time. And I remembered her after she had said she, you know, her part. And I was like, oh my God, she was young, like 13, maybe, maybe 12, 13 on it. And it was just like, again, it's amazing how, you know, these different people that you work with. And she did a great job. She was an amazing director, you know, and to see what she got the chance that, you know, maybe when she was a kid, the women at that age, you know, in 2013, 2010, didn't have half as many chances to do a feature as they do now. And we still have a long way to come.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Anyway, that's one I really liked, and I love the script, and I love the story.
So. No, I think we all need to go watch Don't Make Me Go, directed by Hannah Marks. She's
Hannah
a director.
Marks. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. I will definitely check it out because yes, there's a lot of projects, but not a lot of opportunities given to women to direct. And I mean, that goes into a lot of different conversations, but yes, it's nice to know that you had input on that. And especially helping support first time directors get into bigger budget projects, which I think a lot of us just kind of stay in the indie space for a very long time. And it's important to have support systems and people who want to open the door, right? Okay, Pamela, I want to talk about Almost Home. It's a short film that you produced. And you're because you were... So first of all, tell me your connection to the film, Almost Home.
Okay, so I started with Almost Home. The director, Minhaj Huda, he is an acquaintance, a friend of mine from the Directors Guild that we met over 10 years ago, probably, at the DGA. And so when we have events and things, you know, we would see each other there and everything. Well, we saw each other after the pandemic, you know, at the awards dinner, and he reached out. And so we, you know, would have lunch or, you know, coffee or something. And he told me he was doing this short and, you know, invited me to read it, and I read it, and it was, you know, about military and, you know, PTSD and, you know, what happens to a soul, unfortunately, when, you know, when there's a war. And I was, that hits me in my close spot in the heart because of, I am an Air Force veteran. My mother and father are both Air Force veterans, you know, and I love history. But, you know, I feel like we always need to learn from it, right? There's a way these are stories that need to be told so that people don't forget, that they understand what, you know, how devastating it can be to everyone involved. And you can't get your innocence back, you know? So anyway, when I read it, I loved it. And I love the take on it. And it's a story taken and told in a different way, or a different story, I'd say, than most all of them, right? From a different perspective that people wouldn't expect. And that needs to be told. The more we tell the stories of the few, the more we have empathy for all. I believe that with all my heart. So he introduced me to Kamal, who is the writer and the lead actor in it and producer. And It seemed like they needed someone like me, who was a experienced producer. And I told Minhaj if they needed it, I would be happy to come on board as the producer. And so I did.
First of all, I should have said this first. Thank you for your service. Thank you to your parents for their service, because that's something that I feel like military films are very important. I don't think military families and veterans get, in my opinion, enough attention the sacrifice and the service they make for their country. And I mean, that's my personal opinion. So I feel like if we can use storytelling to in some way open the conversation and raise awareness for some of the issues, like in this film, Almost Home, you said it's about PTSD, but it also deals with a identity of an American Muslim serving in the military as well, which it's very nuanced in that way, because as there are so many American Muslims that, you know, taxpaying citizens, they also, this is the home they know, and then they go and serve for their country, but then they come back. And also, I saw a few early scenes of the pyrotechnics that were used. Could you tell us about the desert? I mean, I know the film is in post-production right now, right?
Yes.
Okay.
We are doing some finishing touches and some visual effects. First, I want to say this is not going to be your normal 20-minute short. You know, if you were like talking heads in a show on one location, a house or whatever, you can make that for almost nothing. If you want to show that, like, you know, you want to have some realistic, you know, we have a huge military scene. That's what you're talking about with the pyrotechnics and everything. And that's going to cost a lot of money if you don't have some connections. And I really want to give a huge shout out to my friend Ilya Popov, who owns GemFX, and they are the best special effects company in the world, worldwide. They work all over the world. They only do like the huge, big shows, TV shows, movies that do, you know, a lot of effects. And they are so, Ilya's so good about like how he trains his people, how they have their approach is always safe, methodical. They can go beyond the bounds of what you can think of because they do everything right, right? They measure it out, they weigh it out, they like decide, you know, is this safe? Okay. And they make sure everything's prepared before they go in there. He teaches people how to talk with, you know, crew and everything. So it's a really great collaboration. I had produced, you know, a PSA for him, you know, or a, not a PSA, sorry. It's kind of like a commercial, but before a show, right? So sponsored by that show. And he and I have been fast friends for years. And I called him up and said, you know, I thought, oh, get the pitch ready. You know, this is about military. This is close to my heart. We really want, this is a message that doesn't get out there much. And I started with the, hey, I'm producing this short. And he goes, what do you need? And, you know, God bless him. He donated everything. He donated all of the special effects techs and all of the pyrotechnics, all the, you know, equipment. I mean, we're talking probably more than $20,000 worth of stuff we didn't have to pay for.
I think one thing to glean from this is that this industry is all about having great relationships and friendships and camaraderie, because you just never know who might support you on a fellow project or future project. Yeah. But I look forward to sharing Almost Home when it's wrapped, but I know we're running a little bit out of time, but what was the social, as a veteran, as someone who served in the Air Force and with this film, what do you hope that you want people to take away from once they see Almost Home? What would you want people to take from that?
I think there's two things that I really, really want to take. the difference in this, as you have said, is that our Marine coming home with PTSD is a Muslim. And, you know, we've had Muslims in all of our wars, Americans serving our country since the War of 1812. Okay. So there's a lot of ignorance out there in our country right now that it's, you know, my country, this and that. I want them to know that there's equality in everybody, no matter who they are, you know, race, religion, sex, that we all suffer. We all go there. We all fight for the cause. We all suffer. We all need help. We all need understanding. You know, I'd really love us to be a united United States.
I love that. Yes. And more than ever, we need unity. And I think that if I could sum up every little take some points from this whole interview, I would say filmmaking is community, it's family, it's a raising awareness. And yes, and I think Almost Home, I'm looking forward to watching it. I'm once again, thank you for your service. I think there is a need for more social impact films more than ever, especially this election year and with all the suffering in the world and the discrimination and the prejudice as unnecessary. I think filmmaking is a great way to have those conversations. And what kind of movies would you like to make in the future? Or is there a project you're working on you'd like to share?
I'm just going to say this because I work with documentaries too, besides movies.
Yes.
It's very important to me that we don't waste someone's time growing up, teaching them incorrect history, like the whole Columbus thing. Okay. Didn't happen. Right. Not the way that they're saying. And I really, like, as an adult, you learn that he didn't discover America, like all of those things. Well, our industry is the ability to tell stories correctly, the ability to tell the stories that aren't getting told in the textbooks, the ability to tell the stories of every person, the ability to tell the truth with facts and documentation, the ability to tell documentaries that make people think, that give people more knowledge so that they can think in a better light. That's what I want to do.
That's 100% correct. And I think now more than ever, like I said, there's a need. And I think that's the beautiful thing about storytelling. There's a lot of stories that have not been told. And a lot of producers and filmmakers and crew that would love to make those films come to and tell those stories. To end our conversation for today, we have a segment called Listen, Reflect, and Connect. Pamela, so I'm going to ask you two questions and then we'll be closing our interview. What does the world need more right now?
Empathy, number one. I mean, I think the world needs more connectness. You know, I think that I would love to see it. Everyone growing up get a chance to go to a different culture and spend 6 months there, you know, so that they understand that everybody is, you know, we have our differences, but we also have a lot of similarities. So empathy.
Wonderful. What do you think the world needs less of?
Ignorance, hatred, lying, cheating, manipulation, all of that.
Bold, underscore, highlight, big, all caps on a billboard, on a t-shirt, on a bumper sticker, 100%.
Yeah. And how can separatism too, like, let's say that bigotry, you know? Yes.
Thank you so much for being a part of this conversation today, Pamela. I learned a lot. And I think there's a lot of great insights for emerging producers and everyone who appreciates a good film and story and how important social impact storytelling and filmmaking is. So I really thank you for your service. Thank you for joining us today. And we look forward to following more of your projects and seeing your documentaries and films on screen. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you enjoyed The Slow Dive, please subscribe and leave us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq, edited by Drew Franceblau. Our theme song is Dive by Sarah.
This is a Slow Dive podcast. I am Farida. Let's make an impact one episode at a time.